The first case for argument this morning is Local 65B Graphic Communications Conference of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters versus the NLRB. Mr. Allison.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Thomas Allison. I represent Local 65B. This is an unusual case. The ultimate legal issue is whether the company violated the National Labor Relations Act by its unilateral implementation of a new performance improvement plan for the first time for this bargaining unit, and the demotion of an employee from his permanent job for work performance reasons rather than treating it with discipline, again for the first time. The resolution of that legal issue is substantially determined by an overriding factual issue. That is, did the parties agree to extend their collective bargaining agreement a day before it was about to expire? If it's found that the parties agreed to extend their collective bargaining agreement, the union would concede that the company's unilateral actions would have been lawful under the management rights clause of the extended agreement. On the other hand, if it's found that the parties did not agree to extend their contract, but instead to go ahead and work under the terms of the expired contract, I think the board and the company would agree that the union's waiver of its statutory bargaining rights contained in the management rights clause would have expired with the contract, and the company's unilateral actions would violate sections 8A, 5, and 1 of the Act. So the outcome of this case pivots on this central factual issue. Did the parties agree to extend their collective bargaining agreement? The testimony on this issue is limited. The discussion at the bargaining table took place between the company's chief negotiator, David McCarthy, and the union's international representative, Phil Roberts. Neither Mr. McCarthy nor Mr. Roberts testified at the NLRB hearing. However, two participants in the negotiations testified. Ron Slade, the company HR manager, testified he couldn't recall precisely what was said about an extension, but did recall that the union would agree to work under the terms of the old contract. Dan Strohecker, a full-time bindery worker and part-time union officer, testified in more detail. Mr. Strohecker testified that the company spokesman, David McCarthy, asked if the union was going to sign a written extension. According to Mr. Strohecker, the union rejected the company's proposal for an extension. Union spokesman Phil Roberts responded the union didn't see any need for a written extension, and it was the union's intention to just work under the current agreement. That was the testimony on this central issue. As described in our briefs, the parties and their counsel clearly articulated their positions on this critical factual issue before the judge, and their positions were well defined. The board's general counsel and the union argued there had been no agreement to extend the contract, and but only to work under the terms of the expired agreement, and therefore the company's unilateral actions violated the act. The company argued that the agreement had been extended, and therefore its actions were lawful. Based on the record evidence, Administrative Law Judge Carson found that the parties had not agreed to extend their collective bargaining agreement, and therefore the company's unilateral actions violated the Act. The company filed exceptions to Judge Carson's findings, and the matter was fully litigated before the board. The two-member board in this case reversed the judge, but in doing so, the board did not address this critical and central factual issue. The board avoided dealing with this issue by stating it was, quote, undisputed, unquote, that the parties had agreed to extend their contract.
Didn't part of the problem looks like they used the term extend the contract and work under the contract interchangeably?
No, I don't believe so. I think when you go to Mr. Strohecker's testimony about what Mr. Roberts said, he didn't see any need for a written extension,
right,
and it was the union's intention to just work under the current agreement. So I think Mr. Strohecker's testimony, which is the most detailed testimony, in fact, distinguished between an extension of the contract and working under the terms of the old one.
What's the difference between extending it and working under the terms?
That's a great question.
This
goes back to the Supreme Court decision in NLRB versus Katz.
So what does "is" mean?
What it means is that if you extend the contract, all of the terms of the old contract remain in effect contractually.
Right.
The contract is totally in effect.
Right.
If the contract is allowed to expire and you work under the terms of the old contract, the company has no more contractual obligations, but it cannot act unilaterally.
And either party can walk away from it?
No, neither party can walk away from it.
Well, if neither party can walk away from it, you're working under the terms of the old contract.
No. Let me just explain a little further.
Does that make sense to you? I mean, just
yes, it's sort of labor agreements are not like magazine subscriptions.
Well, I understand that. I at one time represented two unions, but that just makes no sense at all.
I may have been practicing in this area too long, Your Honor, but it makes a lot of sense to me. The obligation after the contract expires.
I bet you I would go back farther than you do.
I believe you do, Your Honor. When the contract expires, there's no contractual obligation, but the company cannot act unilaterally to change terms and conditions. So it is statutorily required to keep everything in place. But there are certain exceptions to that Section 8A5 obligation to keep everything in place. One of those exceptions is the Management Rights Clause. When the contract, and we've cited some cases that I can refer you to in a second, when the contract expires, the union has a statutory right to bargain over all mandatory terms and conditions. When it signs a contract with a Management Rights Clause like this one, it waives its rights to bargain over certain things during the term of the contract and gives the company the discretion to change those things during the term of the contract. That's what a Management Rights Clause does. When the contract expires, that Management Rights Clause, the waivers contained in that Management Rights Clause, expire with the contract. So although most of the terms and conditions of employment stay in place, the discretion in the Management Rights Clause drops out. And so the company must bargain about changes in terms and conditions that it, after the contract expires, it must bargain about changes in terms and conditions that, if the contract were still in effect, it would have discretion under the Management Rights Clause to do unilaterally. And that's the distinction in this case. And so our position is when the contract was not continued, but was allowed to expire, and they worked under the terms of the expired condition per Section 8A5 of the Act in NLRB versus Katz, the company no longer had the discretion that it would have had under the Management Rights Clause to make these unilateral changes, implement a new PIP program, and demote people from their permanent jobs, which we concede they could have done if the Management Rights Clause was in effect. And that's critical to the thinking of the parties when they make this decision in negotiations. Are we going to extend the contract or aren't? Those are kind of the baseline thinking of people at the table.
Mr. Allison, this case seems to me to be not one of credibility determinations, but rather interpreting competing inferences. At least that. Let's accept that as a potential for our dialogue for a second. And under this substantial evidence standard, how do we tilt toward one inference? Strohecker's testimony clearly can be found to be credible, and as the other gentleman, but. It's pretty close, isn't it? And if it's close, where does the tie go under our deference?
The problem is that the board didn't articulate a reason for reversing the judge's decision.
It's a cursory opinion.
I wouldn't even call it cursory. I would call it a misapprehension of what the party's position was. If the board had gone ahead and said, well, we disagree with Judge Carson that the contract had been let to expire. We disagreed with him for the following reasons. boom, 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 stated what their testimony was they were relying on, stated what the inferences were, and explained the basis for overturning this critical factual assumption, then we would be standing here with this substantial evidence rule dealing with that, and we would be behind the eight ball on that argument. But the board did not do that. The board did not discuss the evidence. The board misapprehended the party's positions and said it's undisputed that
you're,
the contract...
You're into your rebuttal.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. It's undisputed that the contract had been extended, which is just a misstatement of what the party's understandings were. Thank you. I'll save the rest for my rebuttal.
Surely. Thank you, Mr. Allison. Mr. Blitz?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Dan Blitz for the Labor Board. We've heard the union explicitly reference its concessions. We know what the issue is. The issue is whether the board found reasonably that there was an oral agreement to extend the expiring contract. Your Honor asked earlier about substantial evidence, and that is a critical point in this case. The board is entitled to significant deference from this court on this point. The board's reasonable inferences, furthermore, are entitled to significant deference. In reaching its finding that there was an oral agreement to extend the contract, the board cited record evidence. Footnote 6, for instance, on page 1 of the board's decision, was explicitly referenced by the board. This was not an idle conversation between negotiators for the union and the company. This was an exchange between experienced negotiators, and it meant something. It was an affirmative step. It was an affirmative step initiated by the company to extend the agreement. The union's negotiator didn't see the need for an extension, but he agreed, a written extension, that is, but he agreed nonetheless to this proposal, and there was an oral extension.
Did he agree to proposal, or did he say we'll continue to operate under the old contract?
Mr. Roberts, and I'm quoting here, Your Honor, said, we didn't see any need for a written extension, that it was our intention to just work under the current agreement. So the only difference...
Well, according to your opponent, that makes a significant difference. The whole thing swings on that.
With all due respect, we disagree with the union's take on this conversation. We find that the board's interpretation...
What do you disagree with? You disagree with the position
union,
he's taken legally, that if there's a difference, there's no distinction between an extension and working under it?
As I understand it, union
there is a distinction.
As I understand it, union counsel is arguing that there's a critical distinction between an extension and working under the
Amen.
Term.
Amen. That's what he said.
That's correct. And
you disagree with that?
We disagree. One, this conversation was about an extension. The only difference was whether it would be written or oral.
It is about an extension.
Yes,
But the thing is, we don't see a need for a written extension. We will continue to work under the contract. It's not an agreement for an extension, is it?
The board found that it was, and the board's finding is entitled to deference. It was.
Yeah, well, I know. Sit here and discuss this thing. You know.
The dichotomy, to try to answer your question this way, the union is trying to draw a dichotomy between, in effect, a magic words dichotomy. An agreement to, quote, extend a contract versus working under the terms.
That's exactly his position. Well,
I want
to know what's wrong with that position.
Well, first of all, he offers no real case support for this.
You don't think that's the law?
Not the way he's framed it, Your Honor, no.
Well, how about the way I framed it, that there is a distinction?
Let me try to draw the distinction this way. NLRB versus Katz, which union counsel cited and relied on, is a case which creates a statutory obligation under Section 8D and 8A5 of the Act for parties after a contract has expired to refrain from making unilateral material changes to mandatory terms and conditions of employment. It exists as a statutory basis. It's not a contractual thing. Parties could just sit idly by, say nothing, do nothing, and they're under this obligation. That's why would they, you know, reasonably, why would they sit down and give verbal expression to something that comes into force via a statute.
Well, because they were responding to a request to have a written extension, they said, we don't need one. We're just going to work under the old contract. Union sees no need for it.
I see your point, Your Honor. I respectfully disagree. I think the exchange at footnote 6 was framed in terms of a written extension, and the only thing that...
I agree that it makes your position makes more common sense, but if that's not the law, it's not the law.
Well, the law... That was Katz, if I can back up. What Union Counsel, I think, is trying to argue is that parties need to exercise some technical language, some magic words, as it were, to extend their contract.
To say that everybody agrees that this is extended is not true. Everybody doesn't agree. Everybody didn't agree then.
I don't think the board saw it that way. The board found that it was, as you know,
What was the predicate for their finding?
The predicate for its finding, I think, was the footnote, and there's undisputed, uncontroverted record testimony.
He said that we see no need for a written extension.
The testimony about the exchange was the one quoted at footnote 6. The testimony I'm referring to, for instance, is on page 32 of the board's supplemental appendix, where union witness... Strohecker agreed when he was asked, and at all times...
Well, go ahead. Tell me what he said.
He answered affirmatively when the question was posed to him whether at all times when the grievance relating to...
Is that the precise question put to him?
I'll read the question. It was a cross-examination question. And at all times when you filed or amended the grievances, the collective bargaining agreement, including the management rights provision and the grievance arbitration provision, contained in Respondents 1, and that's the contract, was in effect, correct? Answer, yes. So there's record evidence showing that the parties, during the course of the grievance proceeding...
Who's doing this recitation? Who's the interrogatee?
The question was posed by company counsel. The answer was given by union witness Strohecker, who was not one of the negotiators here, but
How does he know?
Presumably he, as a union steward and vice president, would have knowledge.
Well, he wasn't present for the discussion.
I believe he was present.
I thought you said he wasn't.
No. He
said he was not one of the negotiators.
The negotiators, the exchange,
he was just hanging around there.
Was between Mr. McCarthy and Mr. Roberts. He was not one of the participants in that particular discussion. Moreover, the distinction the union is trying to draw, as I think I pointed out earlier, is not founded on any reasonable reading of case law.
Well, what's your interpretation is work under the current agreement equals an oral extension, right?
In these circumstances, yes. The board's finding is entitled to deference. In these circumstances where there was an affirmative action, the exchange quoted at footnote 6, coupled with uncontroverted testimony, the only witnesses who testified were company official Slade, union steward Vice President Strohecker. These individuals corroborated each other. They confirmed that the contract was in effect at the critical times.
There's no question about that. The contract was in effect because they were working on the contract.
And the management rights clause, pivotal management rights.
The devil is in the details.
And the union agreed.
There was agreement. And the management rights clause was in effect. And that...
You mean this one witness agreed?
Witness... Slade for the company and witness Strohecker.
He's not one of the negotiators, so his agreement and disagreement didn't make any difference.
Those gentlemen did not testify. The individuals quoted, Mr. Strohecker quoted what happened there, but Mr. McCarthy and Mr. Roberts did not testify.
Is there some reason why they didn't testify? Is that in the record?
I'm not aware of that. No, I don't. I don't think that's in the record, Your Honor. The union, furthermore, has tried to frame this case as one of credibility. It's not about credibility. There's no dispute about what was said. It's challenged, its attempt to frame this question as one of a credibility finding by the judge.
What witness that you've just, he's talking about his interpretation of what occurs when it's extended, when you throw in the management rights clause as part of it. His idea of what it means.
Well, and
the real problem is what the board thinks it means. And they didn't take that position at all. They just said everybody agreed it was extended.
Well, the board took the position that there was
no disagreement.
It is if I may quote on page 1, it is undisputed that at all relevant times in this case, the parties understood that they were operating under the terms of the.
We know one person understood. That's the interrogatee of the question you propounded. But I want to know, did the negotiator have that position? Did he enunciate that position?
That individual did not testify, so
we don't know. And they didn't mention it. So.
He did not testify, Your Honor.
The ALJ relied on this, what's his name? The person we're quoting, or you're quoting, right? The ALJ relied
on
that.
Well, the ALJ did a few things. The ALJ referred to the testimony, essentially, that the board cites at footnote 6 on page 1 of its decision. But as the board pointed out, the fundamental flaw in the ALJ's reasoning was that the ALJ rejected the argument that there had been an extension because the ALJ found there had been no formal, that is, written extension.
No question about that at all. Yeah. That's what they're relying on. The question is it true?
No.
Had the union agreed to it?
No. No, the board was thoroughly entitled to cite the testimony at footnote 6
sure
and draw the reasonable inference. And courts,
But no, they're entitled to cite it. The question of whether it's a reasonable inference is a different matter altogether.
Submit it is, Your Honor.
I understand. I didn't expect you to confess error right here while we were standing around. But you make it a little simpler than it is, and so did they.
Summing up, let me backtrack. The factual challenge, in fact, that the union has brought is waived insofar as it's now seeking to characterize the board as misstating judges' findings, overturn credibility findings, and the like. It never made those specific arguments to the board. Those aspects are waived. The critical aspect, furthermore, of the union's argument, that is that there is a bright line dichotomy between extending versus working under a contract, is similarly waived. The union never raised that matter in the specific fashion it does, now to the court, to the board. Be that as it may, there is no coherent principle from the case law that says that you have to use magic words, technical language. What happened here was an exchange between experienced negotiators in the face of an expiring contract done to, I suppose, to, foster harmonious bargaining relations, a principle that's recognized completely in the Act, Section 1, in fact. They had an exchange. The only difference was written, but they agreed on an extension. And pursuant to that extension, the contract remained in effect, including the management rights clause. The management rights clause privileged the unilateral actions taken by the company, the PIP process and the demotion of employee Gijas. Summing up, the board respectfully submits that it is entitled to deference on this finding and that the union's petition should be denied.
Thank you, Mr. Blitz. Mr. Hammond.
Your Honors, may it please the Court. I'm Steve Hammond, counsel to the intervener, Quebecor. I think, Your Honor, you've asked the heart and substance of the case, and I'd like to go back to Dan Strohecker's testimony. He was the vice president of the union. I was the one that was in the interrogator. He was the interrogatee. And I think the really critical piece is that the testimony relates to what happened after the agreement was extended. The question that I put to him, which is cited at page 105 of the transcript, is whether the entire agreement, including the management rights clause, remained in effect at all times, including the periods of time, Your Honors, when the grievances had been filed and amended. And it's the grievances that gave rise to the issue of whether or not the company had a basis in the contract to unilaterally demote Mr. Gijas. And so I think the conduct of the parties clearly manifests an actual intent of what was meant by that tricky language at footnote 6. I don't think there, in this context, is a distinction between working under the agreement and extending the agreement based on the conduct of the parties. And I guess, in summary, the company took the union at its word. This was the last day of a contract that was expiring on March 31st, 2006. And as the court held here in the Merck case, there isn't a level of formality that we require in commercial contract cases. This is just two people trying to work out their differences and trying to promote a labor agreement and to continue to
this
work.
This was a bargaining unit since 1918?
Yes. Long time, Your Honor. I have nothing further.
Thank you, Mr. Hammond. Mr. Allison?
First, Your Honors, there is a distinction throughout board law between extending a contract and working under an expired contract. There is a bright line there, and the board's position that those are indistinguishable is contrary to established board and court law, and we cite those cases at pages 19 to 22.
You don't have to convince me of that.
Okay.
Let's get the last one.
With respect to Mr. Strohecker's testimony on page 105, this is a very thin read for them to base this case. This was cross-examination of Mr. Strohecker in the context of some grievances that the union filed.
And Mr. Strohecker speaks to the union on general matters, does he?
Mr. Strohecker is an agent of the union, Your Honor.
So, and he is more than just an agent. He is somebody who's aware of what happens and what goes on. Am I correct?
We are not. That's true.
Okay.
In that testimony at page 105, Mr. Hammond was cross-examining Mr. Strohecker about some grievances that he had filed, the union had filed. And then he asked the question of when he filed the grievances. This is the question. The collective bargaining agreement, including the management rights provision and the grievance arbitration provision, were in effect. The union and the general counsel both objected to that question as calling for a legal conclusion of the witness. It was also compound and confusing. He asked him about
what was the ruling on the objection?
The judge denied the objection. We had a standing objection to that line of questioning, which the judge allowed us.
Reiterating the objection for this purpose.
Excuse me?
You're reiterating the objection for this.
Well, I want to point out, I am doing that, thank you, and I am doing one other thing, which is this is a very confusing question. He was asking him about whether the grievance procedure was extended.
It struck me as being confusing. It struck me as being pretty explicit, that including the management rights clause.
He said including the management rights clause and
the
grievance and arbitration provisions.
That's what
he was asking him about. He was asking him about grievances.
He asked about both.
That questioning was in the context of these grievances that have been filed.
Whatever context, but that's what it was.
The point is that each of those three things has a different status after the contract expires. The management rights clause expires. The grievance clause.
Extended.
Excuse me, Your Honor. I must say it again.
Except when it's been extended.
If it's been extended, it's a different deal. That's where we get back to. These are. There are three things he was asking him about. The grievance clause stayed in effect. The arbitration clause could be in effect or not in effect, depending on what they wanted, and the management rights clause dropped out. So the answer to that question, I think, of a bindery worker, albeit an agent of the union, is a pretty thin read to base your decision on, and the board did not base its decision on that. The board has an obligation, when it overturns a factual finding, to articulate a basis for overturning that factual finding, particularly one as key as this. And that's what the board didn't do. It didn't rely on this one question, conflated question to Mr. Strohecker in its decision. It didn't reference that. And I think what the board is doing and the company is trying to construct the rationale for the board's decision that the board itself didn't do. And I think that's why it has to be reversed and sent back to the board. If you have no more questions, I'm finished.
Thank you, Mr. Allison. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will proceed.